July, Ambrose Bierce. Brought to you by BunnySlippers.com. Check out their brand new Dino Sound Slippers. Slippers that make a roaring sound every three steps. Made with greenish, scaly fabric, soft plush uppers, foam footbeds, and non-slip grips on the soles. And three white claws on each foot. One size fits most, up to women's 10.5, men's 8. Footbed measures 10.5 inches. Check out Dave's Corner of the Universe every last Tuesday of the month, part of our monthly Cthulhu Mythos and other weirdness episodes, or go to his blog at davescorneroftheuniverse.wordpress.com. Also join us later this month when we talk to writer Rami Ungar about his next novel, Rose, which should be out on Amazon right now. You can check the show notes to find out where you can get a copy or check out the reviews for that. I really like it. It's hard to describe, but it would make a really good manga. It's biological body horror. There's spellcasting elements in it. There's elemental spirits. It's pretty cool stuff. And you can find out more about him by going to Rami Ungar, the writer, and that is RamiUngar, the writer.com. Special thanks to all of my guests this month. If you want to be a guest on PGTTCM or Black Clock due to your hobbies or professions in academia, arts, literature, relating to weird fiction, gothic horror, Old English, any of that fun stuff, folklore, Cthulhu mythos, weird fiction, horror in general, contact us and we'll see what we can do. PGTTCM.com/contact to get a hold of us. Black Clock Audio Tales is a daily podcast that reads you a story, either a chapter of a novel or a whole short story. Join us in our exploration of old ghost stories, supernatural fiction, horror tales, folk tales, fantasy, gothic horror, weird fiction, and cosmic horror. And don't forget to join us for our monthly show about the Cthulhu mythos. Look for our podcast wherever you find your podcasts. We suggest Podbean, Apple Podcasts, or Stitcher. Find us on the web at pgttcm.com and Black Clock Audio on Instagram and Facebook. We've got PGTTCM on Twitter and Black Clock Audio Tales on YouTube. Check out People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos on the last Tuesday of each month. Check out our new website at PGTTCM.com. Edited by Daniel Spitzer. Music by Kevin McLeod. Produced at Badger's Drift Studio in beautiful North Portland.
A Baby Tramp by Ambrose Bierce. If you had seen Little Joe standing at the street corner in the rain, you would hardly have admired him. It was apparently an ordinary autumn rainstorm, but the water which fell upon Joe, who was hardly old enough to be either just or unjust, and so perhaps did not come under the law of impartial distribution, appeared to have some property peculiar to itself. One would have said it was dark and adhesive, sticky, but that could hardly be so, even in Blackburg, where things certainly did occur that were a good deal out of the common. For example, 10 or 12 years before, a shower of small frogs had fallen, as is credibly attested by a contemporaneous chronicle, the record concluding with a somewhat obscure statement to the effect that the chronicler considered it good growing weather for Frenchmen. Some years later, Blackburg had a fall of crimson snow. It is cold in Blackburg when winter is on, and the snows are frequent and deep. There can be no doubt of it. The snow in this instance was of the colour of blood, and melted into water of the same hue, if water it was, not blood. The phenomenon had attracted wide attention, and science had as many explanations as there were scientists who knew nothing about it. But the men of Blackburg, men who for many years had lived right there where the red snow fell, and might be supposed to know a good deal about the matter, shook their heads and said, "Something would come of it." And something did, for the next summer was made memorable by the prevalence of a mysterious disease, epidemic, endemic, or the Lord knows what, though the physicians didn't, which carried away a full half of the population. Most of the other half carried themselves away, and were slow to return, but finally came back, and were now increasing and multiplying as before. But Blackburg had not since been altogether the same. Of quite another kind, though equally out of the common, was the incident of Hetty Parlow's ghost. Hetty Parlow's maiden name had been Brownon, and in Blackburg that meant more than one would think. The Brownons had, from time immemorial, from the very earliest of the old colonial days, been the leading family of the town. It was the richest, and it was the best, and Blackburg would have shed the last drop of its plebeian blood in defence of the Brownon fair fame. As few of the family's members had ever been known to live permanently away from Blackburg, although most of them were educated elsewhere, and nearly all had travelled, there was quite a number of them. The men held most of the public offices, and the women were foremost in all good works. Of these latter, Hetty was most beloved, by reason of the sweetness of her disposition, the purity of her character, and her singular personal beauty. She married in Boston a young scapegrace named Parlow, and, like a good Brownon, brought him back to Blackburg forthwith, made a man and a town councillor of him. They had a child which they named Joseph, and dearly loved, as was then the fashion among parents in all that region. Then they died of the mysterious disorder already mentioned, and at the age of 1 whole year, Joseph set up as an orphan. Unfortunately for Joseph, the disease which had cut off his parents did not stop at that. It went on and extirpated nearly the whole Brownon contingent and its allies by marriage, and those who fled did not return. The tradition was broken, the Brownon estates passed into alien hands, and the only Brownons remaining in that place were underground in Oak Hill Cemetery, where, indeed, was a colony of them powerful enough to resist the encroachment of surrounding tribes and hold the best part of the grounds. But about the ghost. One night, about 3 years after the death of Hetty Parlow, a number of the young people of Blackburg were passing Oak Hill Cemetery in a wagon. If you have been there, you will remember that the road to Greenton runs alongside it on the south. They had been attending a May Day festival at Greenton, and that serves to fix the date. Altogether there may have been a dozen, and a jolly party they were, considering the legacy of gloom left by the town's recent sombre experiences. As they passed the cemetery, the man driving suddenly reined in his team with an exclamation of surprise. It was sufficiently surprising, no doubt, for just ahead, and almost at the roadside, though inside the cemetery, stood the ghost of Hetty Parlow. There could be no doubt of it, for she had been personally known to every youth and maiden in the party. That established the thing's identity. Its character as ghost was signified by all the customary signs. The shroud, the long undone hair, the faraway look, everything. This disquieting apparition was stretching out its arms towards the west, as if in supplication for the evening star, which certainly was an alluring object, though obviously out of reach. As they all sat silent, so the story goes, every member of that party of merrymakers, they had merrymade on coffee and lemonade only, distinctly heard that ghost call the name, "Joey! Joey!" A moment later, nothing was there. Of course, one does not have to believe all that. Now at that moment, as was afterwards ascertained, Joey was wandering about in the sagebrush on the opposite side of the continent, near Winnemucca, in the state of Nevada. He had been taken to that town by some good persons distantly related to his dead father, and by them adopted and tenderly cared for. But on that evening the poor child had strayed from home and was lost in the desert. His after history is involved in obscurity and has gaps which conjecture alone can fill. It is known that he was found by a family of Paiute Indians, who kept the little wretch with them for a time and then sold him, actually sold him for money to a woman on one of the eastbound trains at a station a long way from Winnemucca. The woman professed to have made all manner of inquiries, but all in vain. So, being childless and a widow, she adopted him herself. At this point of his career, Joe seemed to be getting a long way from the condition of orphanage, the interposition of a multitude of parents between himself and that woeful state promised him a long immunity from its disadvantages. Mrs. Darnell, his newest mother, lived in Cleveland, Ohio, but her adopted son did not long remain with her. He was seen one afternoon by a policeman new to that beat, deliberately toddling away from her house, and being questioned, answered that he was a-doin' home. He must have travelled by rail somehow, for 3 days later he was in the town of Whiteville, which, as you know, is a long way from Blacksburg. His clothing was in pretty fair condition, but he was sinfully dirty. Unable to give any account of himself, he was arrested as a vagrant and sentenced to imprisonment in the Infants' Sheltering Home, where he was washed. Joe ran away from the Infants' Sheltering Home at Whiteville, just took to the woods one day, and the home knew him no more for ever. We find him next, or rather get back to him, standing forlorn in the cold autumn rain at a suburban street corner in Blacksburg, and it seems right to explain now that the raindrops falling upon him there were really not dark and gummy. They only failed to make his face and hands less so. Joe was indeed fearfully and wonderfully besmirched, as by the hand of an artist. And the forlorn little tramp had no shoes. His feet were bare, red, and swollen, and when he walked, he limped with both legs. As to clothing, you would hardly have had the skill to name any single garment that he wore, or say by what magic he kept it upon him. That he was cold all over and all through did not admit of a doubt. He knew it himself. Anyone would have been cold there that evening. But for that reason, no one else was there. How Joe came to be there himself, he could not, for the flickering little life of him, have told, even if gifted with a vocabulary exceeding 100 words. From the way he stared about him, one could have seen that he had not the faintest notion of where, nor why, he was. Yet he was not altogether a fool in his day and generation. Being cold and hungry, and still able to walk a little by bending his knees very much indeed, and putting his feet down toes first, he decided to enter one of the houses which flanked the street at long intervals, and looked so bright and warm. But when he attempted to act upon that very sensible decision, a burly dog came browsing out and disputed his right. Inexpressibly frightened, and believing, no doubt, with some reason too, that brutes without meant brutality within, he hobbled away from all the houses, and with grey, wet fields to right of him, and grey, wet fields to left of him, with the rain half blinding him, and the night coming in mist and darkness, held his way along the road that leads to Greenton. That is to say, the road leads those to Greenton who succeed in passing the Oak Hill Cemetery. A considerable number every year do not. Joe did not. They found him there the next morning, very wet, very cold, but no longer hungry. He had apparently entered the cemetery gate, hoping perhaps that it led to a house where there was no dog, and gone blundering about in the darkness, falling over many a grave, no doubt, until he had tired of it all and given up. The little body lay upon one side, with one soiled cheek upon one soiled hand, the other hand tucked away among the rags to make it warm, the other cheek washed clean and white at last, as for a kiss from one of God's great angels. It was observed, though nothing was thought of it at the time, the body being as yet unidentified, that the little fellow was lying upon the grave of Hetty Parlow. The grave, however, had not opened to receive him. That is a circumstance which, without actual irreverence, one may wish had been ordered otherwise. End of story.
Recording by Dale Grothman. A Revolt of the Gods by Ambrose Bierce. My father was a deodorizer of dead dogs. My mother kept the only shop for the sale of cat's meat in my native city. They did not live happily. The difference in social rank was a chasm that could not be bridged by the vows of marriage. It was indeed an ill-assorted and most unlucky alliance, and as might have been foreseen, it ended in disaster. One morning, after the customary squabbles at breakfast, my father rose from the table, quivering and pale with wrath, and proceeding to the parsonage, thrashed the clergyman who had performed the marriage ceremony. The act was generally condemned, and the public feeling ran so high against the offender that people would permit dead dogs to lie on their property until the fragrance was deafening rather than employ him, and the municipal authorities suffered one bloated old mastiff to utter itself from the public square in so clamorous an exhalation that passing strangers supposed themselves to be in the vicinity of a sawmill. My father was indeed unpopular. During these dark days, the family's sole dependence was on my mother's emporium for cat's meat. The business was profitable. In that city, which was the oldest in the world, the cat was an object of veneration. Its worship was the religion of the country. The multiplication and addition of cats were a perpetual instruction in arithmetic. Naturally, any inattention to the wants of a cat was punished by great severity in this world and the next, so my good mother numbered her patrons by the hundred. Still, with an unproductive husband and 17 children, she had some difficulty in making both ends cat's meat. And at last the necessity of increasing the discrepancy between the cost price and the selling price of her carnal wares drove her to an expedient which proved eminently disastrous. She conceived the unlucky notion of retaliating by refusing to sell cat's meat until the boycott was taken off her husband. On the day she put this resolution into practice, the shop was thronged with excited customers, and others extended in turbulent and restless masses up four streets, out of sight. Inside, there was nothing but cursing, crowding, shouting, and menace. Intimidation was freely resorted to. Several of my younger brothers and sisters were threatened with cutting up for cats. But my mother was as firm as a rock, and the day was a black one for Sardasa, the ancient and sacred city that was the scene of these events. The lockout was vigorously maintained, and 750,000 cats went to bed hungry. The next morning the city was found to have been placarded during the night with a proclamation from the Federated Union of Old Maids. This ancient and powerful order averred through its supreme executive head that the boycotting of my father and the retaliatory lockout of my mother were seriously imperiling the interests of religion. The proclamation went on to state that if arbitration were not adopted by noon that day, all the old maids of the Federation would strike, and strike they did. The next act of this unhappy drama was an insurrection of cats. These sacred animals, seeing themselves doomed to starvation, held a mass meeting and marched in procession through the streets, swearing and spitting like fiends. This revolt of the gods produced such consternation that many pious persons died of fright, and all business was suspended to bury them and pass terrifying resolutions. Matters were now about as bad as it seemed possible for them to be. Meetings among representatives of the hostile interests were held, but no understanding was arrived at that would hold. Each agreement was broken as soon as made, and each element of the discord was frantically appealed to the people. A new horror was in store. It will be remembered that my father was a deodorizer of dead dogs, but was unable to practice his useful and humble profession because no one would employ him. The dead dogs, in consequence, reeked rascally. Then they struck. From every vacant lot and public dumping ground, from every hedge and ditch and gutter and cistern, every crystal rill and the clappered waters of all the canals and estuaries, from all the places, in short, which from time immemorial have been preempted by dead dogs and consecrated to the uses of them and their heirs and successors forever, they trooped innumerous, a ghastly crew. Their procession was a mile in length. Midway of the town it met the procession of cats in full song. The cats instantly exalted their backs and magnified their tails. The dead dogs uncovered their teeth as in life, and erected such of their bristles as still adhered to the skin. The carnage which ensued was too awful for relation. The light of the sun was obscured by flying fur, and the battle was waged in the darkness, blindly and regardless. The swearing of cats was audible for miles away, while the fragrance of the dead dogs desolated seven provinces. How the battle might have resulted is impossible to say, but when it was at its fiercest, the Federated Union of Old Maids came running down the side street and sprang into the thickest of the fray. A moment later my mother herself bore down upon the warring hosts, brandishing a cleaver and laying about her with great freedom and impartiality. My father joined the fight, and the municipal authorities engaged, and the general public, converging on the battlefield from all points of the compass, consumed itself in the center as it pressed in from the circumference. Last of all, the dead held a meeting in the cemetery and resolved on a general strike, began to destroy vaults, tombs, monuments, headstones, willows, angels, and young sheep in marble, everything they could lay their hands on. By nightfall, the living and the dead were alike exterminated, and where the ancient and sacred city of Sardasa had stood, nothing remained but the excavation filled with dead bodies and building materials, shreds of cat and blue patches of decaying dog. The place is now a vast pool of stagnant water in the center of a desert. The stirring events of those few days constituted my industrial education, and so well have I improved my advantages that I am now chief of misrule to the Dukes of Disorder, an organization numbering 13 million American workmen. The end of A Revolt of the Gods by Ambrose Bierce.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening. Help support the show and keeping it paywall free by going to paypal.me/pgttcm and donate $1 or $5 or whatever you feel, or go to pgttcm.podbean.com and hit that patron button. That will set you up with donating on the regular if you want to keep this show going, if you want to hear 2 episodes of People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos a month, or if you want to hear better stories, higher quality stuff on the, I don't know, monthly readings. We'll see what we can do. Okay, so, you know, you can rate, review, and subscribe wherever you find your podcasts. And we just want to say, check out Podbean. It's straight from the source, Apple Podcasts, and Stitcher. So next month is going to be August Derleth. Send us any mythos stories that you've written yourself, and we're going to be talking about August Derleth and Arkham House Publishing. Month after that, we're going to have Bronte. So, you know, Andrew Grace is going to be here for that. He's going to be here, like, probably a lot. October, we're going to have spooky stories, and that's just going to be all kinds of different ghost stories and spooky stories. And then in November, we're going to be going with, like, old English stories, so expect some Beowulf. All right, everyone, thanks again for listening so much, and I hope your podcast that's coming up next is good, and not like a whole bunch of the ends of podcasts that you're like, oh, I don't want to listen to the person at the end talk about stuff, and then you skip, and then, like, at the end of the week, you have, like, all these ends of all these little podcasts and stuff. I always hear myself in those because I'm like, I don't want to listen to myself try and tell myself to help the show get better. Anyway, thanks a lot for listening. If you got all the way to this part, high fives. Send me a link. I mean, not send me a link. Send me a message on Facebook or Twitter or something and said, hey, I got all the way to the end episodes. #high five. Anyway, you're the best. Keep on going.